Welcome to Street Talk, S&P Global Market Intelligence podcast that offers listeners a deep dive into issues facing financial institutions and the investment community.
I'm Nathan Stovall, and in this episode, we're talking with longtime bank analyst and contributor to our platform, and someone who I've had the pleasure of talking with throughout my career in the banking space, Nancy Bush. Nancy was actually the first guest on this podcast and recently announced plans to retire. And before she stepped away, we thought we'd be remiss if we didn't ask her to come and talk with us and take stock of the research and banking landscape, how she thinks it's changed, and share a little bit of her views on where she thinks both could be going. Nancy, thanks for coming on again.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I wanted to start with the research space, and sort of this is a tough sort of broad question, but beginning with, you know, how you think the sell side has really changed in the last decade. And obviously we had major shifts with global settlement and then the advent of electronic trading, but it seems like we've sort of kind of seen a continuation of some of the trend lines from there. And so that's sort of part one. And part two would be, you've come at it from an independent side, but you've also worked at the big wirehouses too. How have you seen it change? And do you think that someone today could create sort of an independent shop like you've been able to do?
Well, unfortunately, in my view, which is going on 38 years now, sell-side research has not changed for the better. There is less of it, as you alluded to, and there is less of it because of, number one, first and foremost, simply the shrinking of the financial space. Since the Great Recession and the Great Meltdown, clients have had to cut back on commissions, and we've had MiFID, which was the settlement in Europe that has, you know, of course, been adopted by the large investment banks in New York, all of which make commissions for research harder to come by. So there've been a number of things, both secular and cyclical, I think, going on in the shrinkage of the research space. I was very, very fortunate that when I was ready to start up my shop in the early 2000s, that was the time of the Elliott Spitzer research settlement with Wall Street, where independent research had to be supported by some of these houses, and I was able to build my business on the back of that. And when that sort of petered out after 5 years, I was lucky. My platform was established. I had good clients who had rewarded me during that time and were willing to go on. So it's just getting harder and harder to do that. The one-man shop without a trading desk, which was what I had, is almost extinct at this point, and I think it's people who try to enter into that kind of arrangement are just finding it enormously, enormously tough.
You know, we still see it. It has shrunk. I don't mean the independent side, but we still see it. You know, there was calls kind of like people talking about branches. Branches are going to go away, that, you
right.
know, research won't go away. But it does seem like even the big guys feel like it's kind of must have. Do you, I mean, maybe that's too hard to call, but do you think there's any chance that it goes much further down this road of shrinking?
Well, what sell-side clients, or excuse me, what buy-side clients seem to be looking for at this point is mostly access. They're really, I mean, they can get all the quant data that they want, both from S&P Global and from other places. So they don't really need the numbers working. They need the access to management, and that access comes mainly at the very, you know, the big end with the Goldman Sachs of the world. It's very difficult for an independent analyst to get that access. I was lucky in that I had some longstanding relationships with management where I could get access, you know, back in the day, but even now, that would be hard for me. So I think what clients are looking for, they're doing more of their own numbers. They're making they have, frankly, very little use for investment opinions right now. But what they are looking for is access. And in some cases, I think with the best analysts, they also want to hear the thought process. They want to have their own assumptions tested by good analysts. But as far as, you know, the research model as it existed in the year 2000. That just has gone away.
Well, I want to shift towards banking and and really around M&A. And I think back to stuff you've written for us and stuff you've written on your own platform. And one of the sort of most constant themes to me has sort of been a healthy bit of skepticism towards large deals. And we haven't seen, you know, anything like the 90s or anything like that, but you are hearing, and now for 18 months or so, you've been hearing lots of talk around the need for scale and the need for scale to invest in tech. And some people have even put it this way. The argument has existed for a long time and it wasn't true, but it might be true today because of where how technology is changing the business. Do you buy that? Do you think that there's truth to that?
There is truth, I think, up to a point, but that truth or that opinion ignores the fact that the cost of technology increasingly just goes down. Yes, there has been, I think, a period here where banks have had to invest in mobile and digital delivery. And yes, they've had to invest in technology as an aid to compliance increasingly. You've had to have your operational platform at a technologically advanced state. But I think we're going to kind of get to an end of the place where, you know, you need more bells and whistles in banking. So there is, I think, a limited argument for scale. Now, scale has in big deals, and we're about to see this with the new Truist, and we probably will see it with First Horizon. But, you know, scale has meant the ability to downsize your branch network and close branches. But I was just reading an article, I believe it was in the Wall Street Journal this morning, about how many rural communities are left without bank branches now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is going to become an increasingly hot political potato going forward. So I think that the regulatory stance toward branch closings is likely to harden a bit. So, you know, I think the argument for scale as a reason for banks to get together, and as you know, I am incredibly skeptical of mergers of equals, mainly because I've just lived through so many bad ones. But I think the argument for scale is becoming less and less convincing.
So there's a couple of things I want to pick up on there. So scale to invest in tech, maybe less convincing, but it sounds like you put a little bit of stock in, albeit with the caveat that maybe there's some regulatory pressure that, you know, you can achieve cost efficiencies. Because one of the things that comes up to me is, okay, maybe the invest in tech is a real thing, but it is also at a time where we think there's margin pressure, margins at peak, and credit costs are low. So how are you going to achieve earnings growth? Seems like a great way to actually do it. Do you put some stock into that argument? Do you think that that could be driving sort of some of this?
Well, it could be, but you know, there's been an interesting issue that has arisen this year, and I think rightly so. Now, it's getting poo-pooed by a lot of conservative publications like the Wall Street Journal, and that is the issue of stakeholders versus shareholders.
Mm-hmm.
And I think banks sometimes lose the view or lose sight of the fact that they are a regulated oligopoly. They are inferred with or imbued with their banking powers sort of by the grace of the public. And there is, I think, particularly with this sort of leftward drift in politics, I think banks need to be increasingly mindful that there are other constituencies other than shareholders. And, you know, I have no doubt that if one of the most left-wing candidates should win the presidency next year, the whole thing about downsizing is going to change.
One, to your point about the rural branches, I definitely wanted to pick up on that. And we've seen outside of M&A, we've seen the top 10 guys very clearly talk about, you know, we want to be in the top 25 metro markets and maybe not anywhere else, and sort of withdrawal from those markets.
Right.
And M&A is a quicker way to do it. So it sounds like you're kind of getting to a point where you could see a world where, especially under administration like the one you just painted, that could be a real roadblock to sort of the thesis behind some of these deals, meaning that they can't achieve the same level of cost savings because they won't be allowed.
Oh, absolutely. I think that, you know, large deals where there are massive branch closings will become, and this is whether it's Donald Trump or Elizabeth Warren, are going to become increasingly problematic. Just because, and I have kind of a unique view on this because I live in a town that is 60 miles from a major metropolitan area, i.e. Atlanta, but is considered to be a rural market. And, you know, it's, if you talk to small business owners here, I mean, we do have a small institution in town that exists primarily to serve local businesses. But, you know, it's getting tougher and tougher for these people to find credit.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I mean, I bank with one of the large institutions. I have to drive pretty much 25 miles to get to a branch if I need one, and I occasionally do. But it's I think that banks are getting to a point where, you know, branch closings are going to be A, counterproductive, and B, not politically expedient. So I think they need to think about that time. And maybe that's why we're getting deals now.
Right.
You know, when the political climate is still amenable to that. But I think the public perception of banks is very important, and I think that there are going to have to be, you know, there's going to have to be sort of dispensation from the Pope, basically, for some of these companies to continue to hold branches in places that are perhaps not as profitable.
I mean, it feels like to me the industry is held in better regard perhaps than it was in 2009, but it's not where it was pre-crisis. I don't think they've ever really come back in terms of public perception. And with political winds shifting the way you're talking about,
right.
I mean, there's
right.
definitely even a pretty loud voice there on the left. Let me sort of flip that on a second, and this might be hard to say, but clearly the big guys are the lightning rod there. Is there a world where that offers any competitive advantage to maybe the smaller guys?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at where the growth is right now, here in the Southeast, at least in the banking segment, it's in the middle segment. You know, the Pinnacles, the Synovuses, you name them, the UCBIs, United Communities. And you know, yes, they want to increase their presence in major markets, but they're also not abandoning their rural markets because guess what? That's where the cheap deposits are. So, I think there is a competitive advantage. I think that these mid-sized banks increasingly are filling that space. And they will, I think, get, you know, a better regulatory climate toward doing deals. But I think for the entire industry, it's no longer just going to be, we're going to cut X branches. It's going to be, we're going to cut X branches, but we're going to leave some here, 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 and here, because these areas need access to banking services.
Sure, sure. No, that definitely makes sense. I want to flip to credit, is sort of talking about things out on the horizon. I almost feel like we've been lost into a little bit of a false sense of security around credit quality. There is some growing recognition that maybe credit costs have bottomed, but we will have another cycle. Having said that, there's definitely been, you know, post-crisis regulation has changed the way these guys think. They're operating with a lot higher capital. You know, CRE guidance around concentrations was actually enforced.
Right.
But I want to step back and sort of ask the question, basically, do you really think underwriting has improved? Do you think the group broadly has learned lessons? And is there anything out there that kind of makes you nervous?
Well, the thing that makes me nervous is that the low rate environment has gone on for so long.
Mm-hmm.
Because rates rising will be the differentiator. And we're not there yet. You know, every time we think that the rate environment is going to start going up, rates will start going up, then there's a market tantrum and the Fed steps back in to calm things. And, you know, we also have a president who thinks that rates should be zero or lower. So you could just build all the commercial real estate you want free. So it's, yes, there will be a time when the cracks will appear. But that day continues to be, you know, pushed down the road by the rate environment. Now, I mean, we can see where it's happening. I mean, I you know, read an article a couple of weeks ago about, you know, the fact that banks are out there making 7-year car loans. I mean, come on, you know, the car, you know, sort of wears out before the loan is out. So I think there are excesses that are occurring both on the commercial side, and I worry about that ubiquitous category of C and I, you know, which seems to encompass a world of things. And I worry about, you know, some sort of the reappearance of a de facto subprime loan. I worry about it. Do I worry about, you know, housing so much? No, because we're not building a lot of it, and it's, you know, it's keeping its value as a result. But I worry more about everybody has flocked to CNI. You know, everybody has now flocked to auto lending. I worry, but until we see a definitive turn in the rate environment, I don't think we're going to see the real substantive cracks beginning in the credit quality situation. You're going to see, and I'm just going through third quarter numbers now, I mean, you've seen some blips up, but they've been sort of episodic and, you know, eccentric, I guess, in that they're, you know, sort of one-off credits where something has gone wrong, particularly in the C&I space. There's been a bad winter, or, you know, there's been a weather event or something. But no, we're not going to see the systemic crack for a while yet.
I want to pick up on the C&I bit real quick. KBW had a short note out recently that I thought was a sort of very good point, and it was kind of getting at what you're getting at, which is we've seen many people pushing the C&I, particularly folks who had high CRE concentrations. So right. As CRE got a lot of focus, you said, okay, we're going to go to C&I, and it also positioned them for rising rates. So, you know, everybody sort of cheerleaded and said C&I wasn't the problem last time. And they sort of reminded, just by the way, when you have a cycle of any kind, that stuff is going to get more stressed, period.
Right, absolutely.
And it's just really not being, I feel like, kind of appreciated right now. And they made the comment about one-offs too, and said, you know, we've had a few banks who've had one-offs a few quarters in a row. So
right. Is
it a one-off at that point? I mean, there hasn't been the broad numbers, as you said. You just haven't seen it yet. But it does make me a little bit nervous, and whether or not that's sort of the faucets of security. This wasn't a problem last time, so it won't be a problem now.
Yeah, I think we also just need to get, I think analysts increasingly need to challenge management, and probably the quarterly conference call is the place to do this. Okay, exactly what is in your C&I classification? How much owner-occupied real estate is being classified as C&I? When it's, you know, okay, I get it. Maybe it's C&I or maybe it's real estate, you know. So I think we need a better definition of this, and I think people need to get their hands around that whole issue a little better than we have. I mean, low rates have afforded us as analysts, have afforded bankers and analysts a chance to be lazy. And I think that needs to change a little bit, and we need to start challenging, you know, some of those statements by managements. And I think when you were talking about, yeah, having one-offs for several quarters in a row, I think it was somebody challenged J.P. Morgan management about that on a conference call either last quarter or the quarter before. So I think that increasingly needs to, you know, we increasingly need to be asking the question with these one-offs, okay, why is this not a credit cycle? And see what managements have to say.
Yeah, and to me, it feels like some of the times the answer might be, well, this borrower was just extra stressed. The economy is still really good. Well, isn't that where the first cracks start to show up?
Right.
Meaning that we've just eased too broadly. So I think that's a good point.
Well, I my experience, you know, over all these years has been that every credit cycle is different. Now, we may have had the mother of all credit cycles the last time around, because it happened with an asset, i.e. housing, that we were so sure, including Ben Bernanke, remember his infamous, you know, the price of houses has never gone down on a national basis, and there's no reason to think that it will now. You know, we had that reassurance that turned out to be false. So this one will be different. You know, what we need to start grasping is, in what way is it going to be different?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I want to close with sort of a more reflective question, and this is pretty hard, but with the idea of all your time listening to CEOs and management teams, whether on conference calls or on the conference circuit, are there any moments that you really think that were real inflection points, either whether it showed sort of true leadership in the banking space, showed maybe it changed the way we kind of think about the way banks operate, or perhaps you probably even have more of whether they were, you know, true red flags of sort of things to come. Anything really stick out to you?
Well, there are a couple that were fairly early in my career. There was one fairly early in my career. And as a matter of fact, Gerard Cassidy of RBC and I were discussing this a couple of weeks ago at the Bank Analyst Conference in Boston. And I guess it was like 89. It was like the fall of 89. It was after the first big crash, the crash of 87. And everybody had started building office buildings on Route 128 around Boston because that was going to be a huge tech center, et cetera. And, you know, basically the New England commercial real estate crisis had begun. We just didn't know it at the time. So it was at the Bank Analyst Conference, which would have been November 89, that both Walter Conley of the now defunct Bank of New England and Ira Stepanian of Bank of Boston, now absorbed into Bank of America after many deals, you know, were appearing on the stage and were asked about commercial real estate and just basically blew off the questions. I mean, you know, well, it's, you know, and I can't give you their exact answers after this period of time, but everybody looked at each other and just went, oh my God, because it was so evident that they were clueless.
Yes.
About the state of commercial real estate in their town, a few miles from their headquarters, that it became very, very evident to everyone that there was a problem here. I mean, literally, people, I remember this vividly, people were pouring out of the room to get to the phones, to call their clients, to say, there's a problem. You need to get out of these stocks. And that's where it started. That was one of those, oh my God moments, you know, that stayed in my mind all these years. And Gerard and I were comparing notes, and he and I, you know, remembered it the same way. So that was one. Then, of course, the infamous Jamie Dimon comment about the London Whale, which was, well, this is a tempest in a teapot or something along those lines. And, you know, when you hear a CEO say that, there's a problem. There's just a problem. And there was a problem, although not a crippling one for that company. The merger, the large merger conference calls have tended to be revealing in ways that CEOs don't know. They're tightly scripted, but occasionally you'll get a management that kind of goes off script. And though there have been some revealing ones there, the one that comes to mind was Ken Thompson when they bought, what was the California?
Golden West,
right,
yes.
When they bought Golden West. And, you know, they were talking, and the Sandlers, of course, were on the call as well, and they were talking about the pick-a-pay mortgage, you know, and you're listening to that, and you're going, how is this good?
How is a negative amortizing loan?
Right. How does this work exactly, and how is this good? So there have been some of those, you know, M&A calls where I just turned away and went, oh, you got to be kidding me. But, I mean, it's been interesting to me that managements can say something that to them is totally innocuous, where and everybody else on the phone or in person in the room is going, oh, no.
Yes.
So, you know, I think that CEOs are savvier than they used to be, but not as much as they should be.
Well, and in all three of those cases, and I can think of a few too, the ones that stuck out to you are when the investment community is coming to them with either a question or probably level of concern, and they come at them and go, no, it's fine. or you don't get it. And if I think back of the ones that, you know, sort of scared me the most, I remember being in a small group meeting with Bank United, not Candace's Bank United, but Al Kamner's Bank United at a conference. And people wanted to talk about default risk. And all he did was walk us through the product and the brand.
Right.
And and an investor who, you know, I won't call out, but you know, said they're out of their mind when we walked out of the room, and they failed, you know, 7 months later or something like that. Moments where they won't even sort of meet you and acknowledge the kind of concern always kind of stand out.
You brought up a good point. When they resort to talking about brand, there's always a problem because they're working from their own internal talking points.
Right.
They're not addressing a question, and they're, you know, it still amazes me that so many CEOs don't get that, you know, investors are smart people, and analysts can occasionally be fooled, but not all the time, you know, and it's just, don't even try. I mean, if you don't have the answer to a question, then say, I'll have to get back to you, or I'll have the CFO get back to you, or have our credit people get back to you. Don't try to dance your way through it, because it just makes people nervous and scares them.
And then they run out the door and say, sell the stock.
Yeah, sell this. I mean, that one is unique, I think, in banking history, because people were literally gasping when, you know, they heard some of these statements, and it was just quite remarkable.
Well, those are great. And Nancy, I really appreciate you taking the time to reflect and offer your outlook for the future. And also want to thank you so much for being a terrific contributor to us broadly and supporter of us and to me personally whenever I had any questions for you. So thank you very much for coming on again.
Well, it has been an honor and a pleasure to work with SNL, as I will always know it. I don't care what you guys call yourself. You'll always be SNL to me. And it's been a wonderful collaboration that's gone on for many years now. You know, I've always had great editors and had lots of fun and got great input. So best success in the future.
Well, thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to another edition of Street Talk. I wanted to let you know about the newest podcast from S&P Global, called Change Pays. Host Molly Mintz explores gender equality and inclusivity in the global economy, workplace, and markets through interviews with leaders from S&P Global and other decision makers from companies and countries across the globe to try to better understand what it means to create inclusive economies and accelerate progress. Change Pays launches on December 2nd and can be found everywhere podcasts are played.